Cheyenne. And so this is the end of our week officially. Any comments? Well, for you who were here last night, any comments or observations or questions from last night's talk? Or? No. Question depuis hier soir, ou talk hier? Ou observation que tu veux partager?
Question non, mais effectivement, je me suis dit ce matin dans le métro que c'était que la phrase, mais que veut-il dire ou qu'est-il en train de me dire, c'est ça, était une autre façon d'être encore plus attentif à ce que la personne veut nous dire au-delà de ce qu'elle nous disait, derrière les échafaudages.
Peut-être. So, Sophie's making reference to last night in the talk, I told this story that someone, I'm in a training program to lead writing workshops, and the guy who's leading it said, asked us a question after the last stage, and we have to come back next week with something written about it. Question, qu'est-ce qu'ils vous disent? So, talking about the participants in the writing workshop, so you're a leader leading a workshop, and what are the people saying to you? What are they saying by their presence? Because it's a workshop that's around people who are having difficulty. It could be psychiatric problems, health problems, could be children in the 9-3, could be, whatever. So, the question that a psychoanalyst asked him, whom he was working with, a psychoanalyst in a hospital, and she said, qu'est-ce qui te dis? And so I've been staying with that question, what are they saying to me? Not only in terms of writing workshop, but here in my life in general, what are people saying to me, or what are situations saying to me? What is the rain saying to me? Asking what are they saying to me? And Sophie so was referring to that, saying that. Comment tu as dit ça en français?
Que c'était une nouvelle façon de d'être particulièrement à l'écoute de ce que dit l'autre, au-delà des mots.
So, yeah, I'm just translating into English for the talk. That the question helps her to see beyond the words that they're saying, which is part of the whole point of the question, and behind the famous scaffolding that we've been referring to, that I referred to in one of my posts earlier in the week.
I would like to hear about the scaffolding. To hear
more about the scaffolding. Okay. Did you want to add something?
No. Je voulais juste dire que en t'écoutant reformuler, je me dis que pour moi-même, pour nous-mêmes, ça peut être une question qu'on peut se poser. Qu'est-ce que je suis en train de dire?
Exactement.
Qu'est-ce que je voudrais que tu entendes de ce que je dis?
Ou même, est-ce que je... Or even not only what do I, would I like to say, or what am I trying to say, but what do I don't realize that I'm saying, you know?
Oui, c'est ça.
That mm. I'm actually transmitting some kind of message and I'm not aware of it.
Yeah. Most of the time.
Probably, yeah. And of course, then that touches on blind spots that we have blind spots and there's things we can't see. So we remain open to them. Someone recently, I read that when she received the precepts from a teacher, I don't know if it was a Zen teacher, but I think probably, she said that the teacher said, okay, so I've given you these precepts, you've taken these vows, and they will be your guides until you are clear and you don't need them anymore. Of course, what he was saying and what she realized was she will never be clear, so clear that she will never need these again, that there will always be blind spots, there are always things to work on, it's always a work in progress, like we've been, we also talked about this week. So the scaffolding, you know, on one level, so it, we can understand it basically as, okay, you know, in front of a building, there's, you know, out here in the street, there's work going on a building, and they put up the scaffolding while they're building the building or while they're cleaning it or something, and they put up the scaffolding. It serves a purpose. It can be protective. That when we walk down to the metro, there's an area where the sidewalk walks goes under the scaffolding, right? And there's like a cup, you know, we walked under it last night. And that's protected. It's protective for people walking in the street under the work site. It also, the workers can stand on it and work on the building, whatever. And it serves a purpose, and it's very necessary and effective. And then, as we see, depending on where the scaffolding is, what building, what neighborhood, whatever, the needs, then things are put on the scaffolding. Sometimes it can be, someone, Tiago told me that in London at this time of year on the scaffolding, they're all decorated like Christmas packages. The scaffolding, so it looks like a Christmas package with a ribbon and everything, scaffolding all over. And he said, London is scaffolding everywhere. Whereas here, generally, you know, you'll have like a Yves Saint Laurent ad or
iPhone
or something like that. Or sometimes
it's the building.
Exactly. Exactly. Sometimes it's the building itself. The Hotel Lutetia in the Savo Babylon. For a long time, I haven't been there for a while, but for a long time the scaffolding was there, and they had like the building on the drawing of the building or an image of the building on the outside, or what it's going to look like, or what it looked like before, or whatever. So, how does that apply then to us? Well, on one level, we put up the scaffolding as a protection, obviously, right? To protect ourselves and maybe to protect others from us, I don't know. What we think we might be harmful, so we put up the scaffolding. Like we were saying that also last night, you know, we don't react to things because we're afraid we're going to, you know, do a lot of harm or damage. So that's putting up some scaffolding, right, outside so that we don't hurt or so we don't get hurt. It can be we, in a certain situation, we have to appear to be a certain way. You know, we act differently with our colleagues at work than we do with our mother. We act differently with our friends than we do with the lady at the boulangerie. I mean, it's different. So we have different personas or something that we have to be. And that is also part of our scaffolding at times. Now, and on another level, however, when Suzuki, when I read this by D.T. Suzuki years and years and years ago, and I don't know why it came back to me this week when it came up, but whatever. It's actually even the scaffolding actually is in front of nothing, is the thing. That the only thing that's what I said in the post about the concepts, that we have concepts which are actually scaffolding the form the emptiness. So the scaffolding is actually there, but there's nothing behind it. So it's not actually like what we see in the street with buildings, because there's nothing behind it. There's only the scaffold, and even the scaffolding is not real in that sense. It's the concept of scaffolding, or the concept of, I forget, what was the concept that I started out with in the post? Oh, it was the last day. I said that it will be our last day of the retreat, something like that. And I said, oh, because our last day in the heart of life or something. And I thought, no, wow, that's a super concept. You know, that's like the last day, the heart, life, retreat. All these suddenly were like this chain of concepts. Maybe that's where the scaffolding came from. Which is absolutely very useful because it gave us this structure during the week, right? To say, okay, we're all going to do this, and this is what the schedule is. We do it if we can. We don't do it if we can't, whatever. But we said, okay, we're on retreat. And this whole structure, this scaffolding, was very useful. At the same time, we're always in the heart of our life. We're always on retreat. I mean, retreat, not retreat. What I was planning to post today, and I will, has to do with, you know, some of you have heard me tell this story before, but, you know, at the end of a retreat, the disciple says to the teacher, you know, it's been a great retreat. I learned a lot. It was so great. The practice was so deep. I got along with the people here. You know, the work was so easy. Your teaching was so clear, and I love it. And it's been really wonderful here. Tomorrow, we have to leave, and I have to go home, and I have to pay the insurance, and there's my wife, and the car needs fixing, and, you know, my kid needs braces, and I have to go back to work, and my colleagues are really annoying, and I hate my job, and whatever. So what do I do? And the teacher, you know, sat there for a minute, and he said, if you don't want to leave the Zendo, don't enter the Zendo. And the point is, you know, it's not what it sounds like. He's not saying, well, if you don't want to leave the retreat, you shouldn't have even come. You know, don't come to the retreat if you don't want to leave the retreat. He was saying that, and he wasn't saying that. What he was saying, so what happens is we have to put into question all of these words. Okay, so what does it mean, Zendo? What does it mean, enter? What does it mean, leave? What does it mean, practice? So a Zendo is a place where we practice Zen, right? Just directly translated from Japanese, that's what it means. Okay, so then what is practice? And what is Zen? And what is that place? And we question all of this. Okay, we, you know, we work with koans. We know what it means to put things, to question things, right? Or that's what our intention is, or what, even if we just have a little tiny taste of what koans are, we know that it's a question and we don't have an answer for it, right? So, we're questioning this. So, what is Zen? What is practice? What is entering? What is leaving? What is it all, you know? And when we do that, like, when we ask, what are they saying to me? Suddenly things open up. There's so much more space. You know, then you have a whole different experience of the person sitting across from you in the metro, right? And, even if you don't know what they're saying to you. You don't know. But you suddenly have a different, it's like antennas have spurted and you have a different way of looking and thinking and capté. I'm having trouble with English today.
Picking up,
I guess, is that what we say? Yeah. What's being said, or what's being, the actions, whatever. So if we look at this, okay, so where is the place of Zen practice? what is Zen practice? So what is Zen, and then what is practice? So what we're trying to do this week is to see that it's all practice. It's all life and it's all practice. So everything we do is practice. So then, if we say that, well, then where is the Zendo? You know, the Zendo is everywhere. The universe is the Zendo. When I came home last night, I was leaving the metro, and on the sidewalk right in front of me, there, and I took a picture of it, I'll probably post it today with my post, there was a circle spray painted on the ground with a dot in the middle, and around it was written, "Wish you were here." Which is like the thing you write on postcards in French. Do you write that too?
Mm-hmm. Maybe not. No.
No. What would you write in French on a postcard to somebody?
Bijou de Barcelone.
Oh,
maybe French people don't wish that anybody
it was with them. But so this is like the typical thing you write on a postcard. Wish you were here. Having so much fun. Wish you were here. And suddenly I'm thinking, what? You know, like if you're standing there, you're here, you know. And so you're always here, right? You're always where you are. It's like the, you know, the thing that Bernie did. It's like, so this story I've told a million times too, but maybe you were even there, Debbie, I don't know. He had this big conference at the Forum in Saint-Quatre, and you know, so that he asks questions at the beginning so that he knows what to talk about. He makes a whole list of questions. And one of the questions was something about, like, I'm here, I really have trouble with sitting or something because I'm never present or whatever. So Bernie read the question out and he said, okay, let's take this one. And he said, so, first, who's ever not present, can you raise your hands? And people raised their hands. Other people laughed, just like this. But the truth was, and Bernie, he didn't laugh. He said, you know, so you see. And those people, they really don't feel present. It looks to us like absurd. If you're sitting here and you're raising your hand because you're not present, well, you're present, right? But it's possible to not feel present. Yeah. And we all know that, you know. If we can open up our notions, like, so, you know, it's like I always give this practice of trying to translate into a language you don't speak. That's what these questions do, is it opens the space around it so you can experience it, whatever it is, right? So if you open up the questions around Zen and you try to find what is Zen, and you keep asking it and keep asking it and saying, okay, well, so that, okay, this is Zen. Open it up. Huh? Okay, that's Zen. Open it up. That's Zen. Until it's like the set that contains all sets. I know we have this discussion with mathematicians. I won't go into that, but you can ask Laurent if there's such a thing as a set that contains all sets.
What would be set in French?
Un ensemble.
Un ensemble qui contient tous les ensembles.
Is the answer no?
Well, I've had different responses. Actually, I first heard this discussion, had this discussion with Bernie Glassman, who was an astrophysicist, and so was very steeped in mathematics. And he maintained that there's l'ensemble qui contient tous les ensembles. But when I was in Portugal once, many years ago, and I talked about this, there was a mathematician in the audience, in the retreat, and he, you know, came up to me after and said, that's really intriguing, but, you know, and he told me this mathematical thing. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, so we had a discussion about it, and then he then wrote, at the end of the week, he gave me a paper with stuff written on it about it. I have it somewhere, but...
I think it's the problem is that if you have a set that contains all sets,
where
then it has...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It has to contain the set that doesn't contain the set that contains all sets.
Exactly.
That's impossible.
It was something like that.
Yeah, that's how it breaks and makes.
I think it was something like that. And I think, according to Bernie, it's not impossible. I think it's something like that.
Maybe he was in practice.
What? Maybe he was in practice for that.
Distorted the math.
In any case, how did I get to that? Oh, so it's like you, or like I like the thing of the lowest common denominator. I really like math, in fact, so I'm always really interested to hear what mathematicians have to say. So, in this thing of the lowest common denominator. Now, I know people sometimes think of that as being like the worst thing possible. You know, it's like the stupidest person is the lowest common denominator. But I don't mean it in that sense. It's like if you keep reducing and reducing and reducing, what are you left with? You know? I really like the beauty and the poetry of math, and it speaks to me. I know you told me that Laurent isn't at all like that, right? He doesn't like the...
Oh, no, there is beauty to math.
But I thought he was not
He's
into
not
that
He's not into the philosophy of math.
Oh, okay. But he appreciates the beauty and the poetry of it. Okay. This is what happens when we ask these questions. We keep inquiring. And so when the master says this, he's gone as wide as he can go, and everything is the zendo, and there's no inside or outside of the zendo. There's no retreat or not retreat. There's no coming and going, right? It's when we create the separations, when we stick to the concept, the scaffolding of retreat, not retreat, coming, going, zen, not zen, zen, life, whatever, practice, life, that's when we have the difficulties. And we don't like it. We don't like to come and go. We don't like things to change. But we're the ones who are creating the separations that make it difficult to be one with change. When I say we are creating it, we are hanging on to these differences because the differences are there, right? There is a difference between, if we are sitting here today, there's a difference between Joy sitting here and Tomas sitting in the hotel room. There's a difference, absolutely. At the same time, it's all practice. It's all the zendo. Even though this is a zendo and that's the hotel room. But it's all practice and it's all the zendo. It's the scaffolding, though, that gets in the way when we put this stuff up. We create this scaffolding around zendo and hotel room, and then we can't get out. And we're stuck there.
You also said there's nothing behind the scaffolding. If you take it off,
there's nothing there. Yeah.
But that's where it's also hard to grasp.
Well, because it can't be grasped, exactly.
Yeah.
When I say that, though, what it means is that there's not what we think is there. So, you know, there's scaffolding around the zendo that... You know, defines this as being the zendo. We take the scaffolding away, it's still a zendo. It's still here, but it's just not what we thought it was. It's still a hotel room, but it's just not enclosed in what we thought of as being hotel room. It's the famous thing of Dogen Zenji, who said, at first, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, right? So, hotel room, zendo. And then, when we put it into question, when we open up all this space, what is it telling me? What is it? Qu'est-ce que c'est? You know, what is it? And when we really inquire and we open up the space around it, we don't know anymore. We don't know what it is. We don't know hotel rooms, and we don't know what it is. It's not anymore what we thought it was. And then, so that's when Dogen says, mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. They're all one. There's no difference, it's all one, okay? That's this space of, it's all practice. It's all Zendo, right? And then, he says, after that, and then maybe, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, but not like they were at the first stage. That's where we come back to. It's a hotel room, it's a Zendo, and there's no problem because we know the oneness of it. We know that it's all Zendo. We know that it's all hotel room. We know that it's all practice. We know that it's all life. And therefore, we can truly respect the space of the Zendo, and we can truly respect the space of the hotel room. And the hotel room, because it's just what it is, well, we sleep there and we stay there and whatever we do there, we could also use it as the Zendo. We could also, Tomas could be sitting there doing meditation while Maru's sleeping. We could have done a connection here with FaceTime and he could be listening to the talk. Or we could have a situation where people sleep here because they can use this as a hotel room. So it's not that there's nothing there like we think there's nothing there. It's that what we think is there is not there. Maybe something like that. Because think is always conceptual. So, whereas experience is not conceptual.
When you made the reference to the scaffolding, it was on around the day or around the person or around?
I think I started out with, it was I said it was this concept of this is our last day in the heart of life. Was a big concept, and I said, concepts are, I was reminded of D.T. Suzuki, who said concepts are like scaffolding that we put up around situations, around ourselves, our identity, we build this thing, and then we put a decoration on it, and or a situation, scaffolding around Zen retreat, around heart of life. What's the heart of life? I often tell the story too that when I had my second baby and I was living in the house in Montreuil, and it was really hard because I had two little kids and one had to go to school and the other one was at home, and it was complicated, and I could never sit with everybody else in the Zendo. And like I said this morning, and I was sad, and so one morning, I sat by myself all the time when I had a moment when the baby was having his nap, And I felt like I was really excluded and really far away from the practice. Absurd, because I'm living in the Zen community, and my teacher is in the room next door, and I'm feeling like I'm so far away. But that's how I felt, And so I'm sitting there, and then suddenly something happens. I don't know what. The doorbell rang, or the baby coughed, or I don't know, something. And suddenly I was like, whoa. It was like, the circle of wishing I was there, and in fact, suddenly I'm there, and I'm there, And I thought, wait a minute, I'm always in the heart of my own practice. I'm always in the heart of my own life. I can't be anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it changed everything for me. I, of course, there were times when I would have liked to have been doing something else, but I no longer felt that feeling, that sense of being excluded or being apart or being far away, because I was always in the heart of it, of my practice, which is, that's the only thing we can be. That's the only place we can be. We can't be in the heart of somebody else's practice, except that we all have share the practice. So, you know, it's like the middle of the circle. We are all the center, you know, like, it's true. You know? And we are all the center, you know, different spots. And it's important to see that, that there's different spots.
So, did that change something? Because to realize that you're always in the middle of your practice and of your life, did that change something?
Yeah, it did for me, yeah. It changed the way that I experienced then what I was doing, you know, that changing diapers was practice, you know, or going to sit in the zendo and lighting a stick of incense was life, you know, that there was no, it helped me so much to expand my experience of life and practice, that by when I was changing diapers, I wasn't far away from the practice, that was my practice, at that moment, that was my practice. And it helped me not only with, you know, okay, child, raising children and like formally sitting in zendo and going on retreats, but also like with my writing, because I could then, whenever the moment arose that I had time, then I could write. And that too was part of practice, and I could give myself entirely to it. Or going to work, you know, going to the newspaper was practice. It was also life, and life was practice, and practice was life. So it did change, yeah. It helped me a lot. Of course, I've deepened it and deepened it throughout the years. This was 20 years ago. But I've deepened that. It's helped me to deepen my practice through that.
I have a question. I was going to ask whether can you get the clarity without getting answers? And I think that in general our tendencies are that we are trying to look for answers that may not actually exist. But then I got confused, because when you're talking about math, actually in math, even if we cannot find it, there are always answers or solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't solve the problem, but actually there are answers which we don't know.
In where, sorry?
In math.
In math.
In
math.
In
math.
Math.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm far away.
Because I remember that a few days ago I got really upset about I think it's probably consequences of these tendencies, that unless you understand yourself, I mean, whatever questions you may actually have, you are not convinced, and you know you are not at ease, so you always have a tendency of trying to understand, and you know. And then I got stuck with this question that, oh, you know, I understand that if everything is unknown in life, then, you know, maybe it's easy, so that you accept from the very beginning that, you know, everything is unknown and you just have to accept as it goes on. But it seems everything is unknown in our future life or whatever, except one thing, which is that we are all going to die. And I was thinking, like, why, if everything should be unknown, then everything should be unknown. And why there is one thing that is known that confuses me totally. And I got really upset with this thing, because I cannot understand that, you know. I was trying to find some logic or find some answer, like, you know, something that can convince me, okay, so I got it. Because if you're not in the status that, you know, I feel not convinced, and I don't have an answer, I got confused, like, you know, and then it even made me, like, you know, feel very angry about this kind of things.
Yeah, it's true that when we're questioning, know when I'm talking about questioning. If we're really questioning, we're not looking for an answer. There's an inquiry that's happening, but the answer that we're looking for, if we are looking for an answer, and of course we are at times mm-hmm. looking for an answer, it won't be what we find. And maybe it's true that, well, in fact I know that it's true, that the whole, you know, the whole process that we go through in learning this practice is becoming familiar with not knowing, because we don't know, actually. Not in the way that we think we don't know, but we don't know. And even death, okay, let's say we know that's the only certitude that, and taxes is my thing, I'd like to say, death and taxes, but we even that we don't know, because we don't know what that is, actually, death. We, of course, we know clinically, we know that this body then doesn't function anymore and whatever. We don't really know what that means, and we can't know what it means because we're not there, you know. And when we witness it, you know, a loved one dies, or we hear someone who dies, or we see a body of someone who's died, we have, of course, an experience from it, but we're outside of it, in a sense. It's not our experience of death. We have an experience of someone dying, but that's not the same thing as our experience of dying. It's unknown. We don't know that, too. So what we do is we open to this not knowing by questioning. We question things, and we don't know. You know, I don't know what they're saying to me. I don't know what people are saying to me. It's in a writing workshop or whatever. I don't know. I'm opening up to it. I don't know what they're saying to me. And then when I've opened up to it, I am more receptive, like I said, with the antennae, to just, as we say, bear witness to what arises. Not coming to it with my ideas about what it is, or what it should be, or an answer, you know, that, so I've been questioning and this is the answer. Even when I say, you know, okay, suddenly I was like, oh wow, yeah, I'm always in the middle of my own practice. That's not an answer, really. It's an experience of suddenly what I was feeling. Suddenly that's what I experienced. But what that practice is and what the heart is still remained elusive, ungraspable, unknown. And when we then bear witness, then we can act accordingly to the situation. Then we can have a better chance of responding to the person who's in front of me if I don't come with my set of concepts and my scaffolding about the person, about what I want the person to say, what I don't want them to say. I had a dream this night where some guy was asking me a question, and I realized in my dream that I was telling him the answer that he wanted to hear. And I remember in the dream thinking, why am I doing that? Why am I telling him what he wants to hear? When I knew it wasn't mm-hmm. true, you know? It was, you know, some dumb thing. I don't even know what it was, but it was so clear. And so that's when we come to a situation with our scaffolding of what we want the person to hear, or what we want to say to them, because we want them to like us, or we want them to be happy or something. But then that's responding to the scaffolding and the concept instead of responding to really what is arising. So, you know, I understand that it's frustrating to not have answers, but the rewards are the richness that we can experience when we can let go of that. It's worth it. In my experience, it's worth it. And I see how with other people too. Does that answer kind of the...
Yeah. It made me also think that when we're actually asking questions, we may actually have already answered that we want to hear.
Yeah, often.
Without knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes we ask questions and we already know the answer. We're not aware that we know the answer, but we already know it.
And Joy was saying that this makes you angry. I've been finding the last couple of years it makes me kind of more frightened than I knew I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, all these things that I don't know what they're going to be. Unsettling, in any case. Destabilized, yeah.
Well, and that's true, because, and when we're feeling that, we're projecting already then into, we're anticipating what might arise. But if we really can experience the impermanence, the unknown, the constant change, we can truly then appreciate this moment, because this is the only thing there is. You know? So better appreciate it now, because it ain't going to be here, and now it's gone. You know. So, and there's really no reason to project, because we don't know. So. Why not just
there's no reason, but I think it's a bad habit.
And it's a human response, absolutely. Yeah. But when I say no reason, it's when we can experience, when we realize that, and we become a little more comfortable with just letting things be as they are, then we see that, oh yeah, it's great. It's so much more relaxing, let's say, to not try to project and become anxious and...
But I think that explains a lot of things as far as I'm concerned. This is what you have just said. You know, I was thinking, like, why I try to, you know, everything has to make some sense for me, then I feel better. But why you actually want things to make sense to you? Because it gives you certainty.
Yeah.
And you can kind of hide behind that, you know, your fear. And I just realized recently that I've never remembered myself being such a fearful person, but suddenly this range of fear is coming a bit too much. And I think that maybe you, from the moment when you actually put the key in the door of this unknown world, that you, as you are saying, that maybe we are sort of yielding to that possibility that, you know, you open the door and there is an unknown world. You know, it's okay to step in, but from that moment to suddenly, I think it kind of stirs this all potentially sleeping fear that I never even, you know, imagined that I had in me, just coming up like that. Because I feel so, as you said, I feel so unsettled, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and then I become such a, like, you know, fearful person on every single thing that I see in this world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think we can all recognize it, huh? Definitely. And it's important to acknowledge it and say, okay, yes, I see it. But then to just keep open, you know. So what is this fear? Keep inquiring. You know, it would be like if you're on the scaffolding and suddenly you see that there is no scaffolding and you're up in the middle of the air, you know. Oh, my God. But in fact, when we have that fear, it's because we're still holding on to the idea of scaffolding. But if we're not holding on to that idea of scaffolding anymore, well, then we don't have anywhere to fall. There's nothing to lose. You know, it's my Zumi Roshi who said, "Yes, okay. Well, if you have this in your hand, that's what I have. So if I hold this in my hand, of course I have it, right? I have this in my hand. My hand's closed, and I have it." But if I open my hand, I have everything. If I close my hand, I just have this. But if I open my hand, I have everything. we're afraid of opening our hand because we're going to lose something. But without realizing that if we open our hand, we have everything.
Like walking from, what's the going? Walking from a...
Stepping forward from a 100-foot pole.
Pole.
Yeah.
Do it again. Stepping.
How do you get down from a 100-foot pole?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, terrifying, 100 feet, I don't even know how tall that is anymore, but it's tall. I used to be afraid of the high, you know, diving board when I was a kid, and everyone was going on, and I had to do it too, and I hated it. I hated jump. I don't like heights like that, but, you know, so what do you do? If we stay at up there on the 100-foot pole, we, you know, we think we're on, up there, right? We've realized so much, we're so clear, we know where we are, we're enlightened or whatever. We've got to this place where we're comfortable, the house is good, kids are good, family's good, whatever, financially everything's good, and I'm happy and whatever, and then you have to, boom, something happens, and, well, what do you do? It's a koan, so I'm not going to. I'm not going to go into it, but it's everybody's koan, you know. We just don't think of it that way. But
sorry. Actually, this remind the whole discussion reminds me a lot about something I talked about, and that I mentioned during the retreat that. A teacher who said, when he was asked, what did that change for you? What practicing changed for you? What did practicing change for you? And he answered, I don't know, because I've been doing it since I was 20 years old, and I've changed a lot, but maybe I just grew up. Maybe it has nothing to do with practice. And that answer, I actually thought it's. I've thought a lot about it since last summer, and it's a really important answer for me. And I think maybe I think when I talked about it last summer, maybe it sounded a little bit maybe a little bit nihilistic. I don't really know. Like I was saying, there is no point to practice. But you said 5 minutes ago something that. Really goes along how I heard that answer, that if we open up to the possibility that there is no answer, if something else, something can happen. It's there is value in that, and when I hear the answer, I don't know what it's. I do not know what practicing changed for me from a. A man who's been practicing for 60 or 40 years. He's just leaving me with the question. He's not saying there is no point to practice. He's just completely leaving me with that anxiety that is behind this question. It has to be useful. It has to solve all my problems in life. And when I hear that answer, I'm given the opportunity to just stay with exactly that, exactly the question and what's there, and just don't touch anything and just stay with it right as it is.
Yeah.
And that's really why that question was important. I mean, it's
And that's important.
Reminds me of Stephen Batchelor when he was here, I think, during the discussion after someone said how hard it was for him to practice because he didn't see any change. He was still angry and still this and that and still. And Stephen Batchelor said, yeah, well, it didn't change anything for me either. That's not the point. Or I don't know how he said it.
Yeah.
But I'm still grumpy. I'm still... You know, whatever. It's not it. Right? He doesn't mean that one. It's just not going to change our who we are. How do you say it usually? Choose it. It's just you're stuck with yourself.
Right. Exactly. This is it.
Yeah. But that's about considering what you would have been like if you hadn't practiced. I mean, I'm not great, much greater, but I know if I hadn't practiced, I'd be really.
Well, and what I like to say is that okay, yeah, it's not going to change who I am, but it changes my experience of who I am, and it changes my experience of others and the world. That's what change. If there's anything that changes, it doesn't change the vehicle, you know, the container. It's not going to change that. But it does change. For me, it changes my experience. But it's moment to moment, so it's not something like suddenly I've arrived and it's different. It's like it's moment to moment because the practice is a work in progress. It's ongoing. It's moment to moment, so every moment is something different. Yeah, I don't know what I would have been like, but I can't possibly know what I would have been like without this practice, but I don't know. But like this guy, you know, I mean, I've done so many other things in these 25 years that, you know, I don't know, I did psychoanalysis, changed husbands and had two kids and, you know, I did just so many things that also had an effect on my life. It's all one, you know. But my experience of the nature of things and being is different. That's true. That has changed.
And just when, if I consider the difference between when I first started practicing, the notion of not knowing was, I thought, was the most exciting thing I'd ever heard of. And now, when I think of the idea of not knowing, it's exciting already, but it's really kind of terrifying. It's just, you know, I can't, and I keep thinking, well, go back to that moment when you and just say, oh, this is so much fun. But I can't, you can.
But it's true, that is, you know, speaks to the duality of it, because it's both. You know, it's both like potential anything possible and, oh my God, total chaos. You know, nothing there. So it's both. It really is both. And at different moments in our life, we have different, you know, I think with age too, we become more in contact with the, less in contact of anything is possible with the, oh my God, anything is possible.
I don't want anything is possible. I want just two or three things possible.
That's right. And these specific things.
And if you don't mind.
Sorry.
I think it reminds me of conversations that I had with you some time ago, that at the end of the practice, I didn't actually get anything out of it. I mean, it's totally possible, because when I was hearing about changes, I think that there is a slightly, you know, when people are talking about changes in this context, it sounds like there's some sort of nuance attached. Hopefully people are saying when, you know, changes, they maybe have expectations that somehow the changes have certain directions, or, you know, changes hopefully moving, I don't know, to a direction that they actually wish the changes to go, but maybe there is no direction. I mean, the changes can be totally chaotic, the changes can be totally like all sort of directions that doesn't bring you to any point, which is also totally possible, and it's also part of this unknown probability. But I think that, I mean, often it's not not our natural tendency to embark anything with that kind of understanding already, that you may just hit the rock bottom at the end. I think that people have, you know, if you actually started this practice, you know, you're relatively new and whatever, and then I think that there is, or they kind of project this kind of hope that you bring something to you, you bring you to this direction or that direction, which is direction. Yeah, whatever that is, but it may actually not happen.
It won't, actually.
It won't happen.
It won't
happen. That's why I was asking now. It comes back to my first question, like, can you still get clarity even if you don't get you know, whatever changes that you may wish.
Oh yeah, that's right. We didn't address that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's important for me, at least, that even if I don't get any answer, I don't get any sense of direction, so nothing. But can I still get clarity in the middle of all this kind of chaotic spinning of changes, whatever that is?
Yeah. I mean, the width and the depth of the not knowing becomes more clear. Yeah, that's true. But it's because we have managed to. The reason it's not clear is because our mind is so cluttered with everything we want, think, believe, project. So that's why we don't see clearly. That's why it's not clear. So yes, it is possible. There was something else. I can't remember what it was when you were talking. It came up. I don't know. It's another way of looking at it too is the this Tibetan shema, I guess we call it, a way of looking at the universe, which appears often in Asian cultures. So maybe it'll be familiar to you from Korean culture. I don't know. There's three parts. There's sky, earth, and human. Right? And sky, in what we're saying, is the equivalent of not knowing, of the absolute, of oneness. The sky is empty. There's nothing. Earth is the equivalent of the relative world, the world of form, of differentiation, concept, and that's also, it's there in that world where we can bear witness, where we can truly experience things as they are. We can, there's form. In the sky, we can't, there's nothing to see. There's no form. Nothing has any shape or size or color. It's just nothing. But Earth, it does. And then human is what the link is between the two. So it's through us that, in our action and our living, our breathing, our seeing, our walking, whatever, loving, whatever we do, creating, is where the two are joined, and how the two can be expressed. The sky and the earth are expressed through us. And when we are attached to one, too much, when we put too much emphasis on earth and not enough, we're not in contact with sky, we're not fully expressing our humanity. We're not fully incarnate. What do we say in English? What do we say for incarnate in English? Embodying. We're not fully embodying. And if we are only, if we're too much in the sky, we say people, they don't have their feet on the ground. They're not in contact with reality. There's just too much in the sky. And in order to embody fully our humanity, we have to make the link between the two. The positive and the negative?
Yeah. Electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Incroyable.
C'est ça.
C'est notre énergie de vie, mm-hmm. Ça vient des deux.
Des deux pôles.
Deux pôles.
Voilà, c'est ça.
Voilà. On est d'électricité.
And this is not an easy thing to balance out. I have a whole bunch of my sink leaked, whole bunch of house material problems. And Bruce was just saying, I feel like I don't have any transcendence whatsoever. All I do all day long is think about Kailash and V and C and all these things that I'm not interested in. All this really, I mean, they're important. I'm supposed to take care of them, and I'm like stuck in material problems. It's never happened to me to this degree before, and I can feel that I'm like this, and I'm unbalanced, really. Yeah.
Well, that's why we sit, you know, because that helps us to
encounter,
experience something other than mm-hmm. just this, you know. We experience just what arises, but we experience it differently than if we're just focusing completely on it. Of course, you know, the Zen way is that if you give yourself entirely to something, to the carrelage, you know, or whatever it is, cooking, chopping the carrots, if you do it entirely, well, then that you will experience the transcendent, mm-hmm. quote, transcendence of it, because it's not transcendent. It's not somewhere else. It's here. You know, that aspect, too, of life is here.
Si tu es à 100% dans ce que tu fais, même si c'est matériel, mm-hmm. tu peux être quand même... Tout dépend de l'état intérieur. De comment...
If you are attached to... Like we say, you know, if you're stuck in one, if you have too much emphasis on the relative and you don't see the absolute. That's why we spend so much time, you know, talking about the absolute and oneness and all of this practice. Not because that's the whole point of life, but that's what is missing so much from our usual experience of life. And therefore, then, when we encounter it, we have some little glimpse of, wow, the absolute. Unknown, you know, or whatever, it seems like that's it. And we chant even, you know, rencontrer l'absolu n'est pas encore l'éveil. Just because you have this glimpse of the absolute is not what it's about. Of course, it's important because that's, you know, that's part of the equilibrium of life. But if you just focus on that, you're missing this. So... the whole key is the balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we can balance it is by being it. You know, tu es cela. Being it fully. The electricity, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how electricity works, but I'll take your word for it that it's only two poles. Yeah. Is that what it is? It's I know there's the positive and the negative, and Ben Franklin had a key on a kite string, but you know, it was struck by lightning, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't know how he didn't get electrocuted, but okay. So it's like I put in that email this morning. If anyone read it, I don't know. I sent it after you had already left. I put that quote that I love from Confucius, who said, "We have two lives. The second one begins when we realize we only have one." And that's it, huh? That's really it. There actually is no sky and earth, you know. Okay. Thank you. Merci. Obrigada.